Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm welcoming today in our director's cut André Sapir. André Sapir is a senior fellow here at Bruegel and will be publishing a paper on the WTO reform that is necessary in order for China to be compatible and for the Chinese economic system to be compatible with the global multilateral trading system. And today I'm discussing with him this paper. Now, let me perhaps say a few words in terms of introduction. The first point I want to make is that, of course, the issue of China is on the top of the European policy agenda. You've seen the European Council yesterday, even last week, even though most of the media attention was given to Brexit, did have a point, and it was the first European Council that actually seriously wanted to discuss China. Now, that was pushed a little bit to the back, but it was part of the discussion. And you have seen that the Chinese president, President Xi, was in Italy. Italy signed the Belt and Road Agreement with China. And you have seen that President Xi was in Paris meeting with President Macron, Chancellor Merkel, and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. And certainly one of the defining issues will be how Europe will position itself vis-a-vis China and vis-a-vis the Chinese economic model. And the big issues that I think are on the minds of many policymakers when it comes to, let's say, the more narrow economic relation with China is the role of the Chinese state and the Chinese economy, and it is the role of China when it forces companies to transfer technology under certain conditions to give foreign firms access to its market. Now, these practices in principle are not compatible with the global multilateral rules, but the global multilateral rules could be reformed to make that that system actually compatible. Where is China in the WTO? Where are we?
China has been a member of the WTO since December 2001, after a long process of accession. And it's clear that from day one, everybody knew, China knew, and the membership knew that China had a different economic system than the rest of the membership or most of the countries in the membership, including Europe and the United States, this sort of what China calls itself a socialist market economy system. Maybe there was hope on the part of some, whether that hope was reasonable or not, it's a separate matter, that China's economic system would evolve, would come closer to ours. But that has not been the case. And I think the real question today, the big question for China, for the WTO, for Europe, for the United States, for the system, is whether indeed this Chinese system, this socialist market economy system, is compatible with the spirit and the letter of the WTO system, which was created first as the GATT system and has evolved into the WTO system. And it's clear that that system, created by the United States, by European countries, joined later by Japan and other countries, was predicated upon what one would call sort of a liberal understanding, a system where the state plays not a leading role, certainly not the Communist Party, liberal in that sense, not just a market economy, but with private actors playing the main role. In the case of China, now that it's almost member for 20 years, I think now we have come to realize that China will keep, at least for the foreseeable future, its economic system, and that economic system is different from ours. And I think this is really the question, you know, how to deal with that. I think there are two views that are being put forward about this. One may call perhaps the Trump view. And the Trump view could be said to imply regime change. That, you know, unless China really changes its regime, abandons this socialist market economy and becomes a market economy like we are, we in the West, the system cannot continue, and that could have implication even for the United States leaving the system at some stage, saying that, you know, if China remains in the system with its own system, then the WTO system cannot work. An opposite view is to say, well, you know, the WTO should welcome diversity of systems. It doesn't say anywhere in the WTO rules that there is only one system that is compatible with one economic system that is compatible with membership of the WTO. It's in the fine line. It's implicit, but it's not explicitly present. And therefore, you know, the system has to adapt to the fact that there is a China out there. Now, our view to Petros Mavroidis and myself is that the Trump approach to this, which is sort of a bilateral approach, which risks in itself by its bilateral nature to destroy, to be so confrontational that it risks itself to destroy the WTO system, that this approach is not in the spirit of multilateralism that I think Europe certainly wants to preserve. So doesn't fit with that. At the same time, we do not agree in a sense with the view, the Chinese perhaps view, that the WTO has to adapt to the fact that there is a diversity of system. That could have worked if China was a smaller country. But given the size, given the systemic nature of the Chinese economy, an economy which is roughly of the same size as Europe and the United States, it really sort of undermines the system. Even though it may not undermine the explicit rules, it undermines the spirit of the system. So our view is we need to find a solution which is not this Trumpian bilateral confrontational, nor the Chinese view, which is the system needs to adapt to us. No, our view is that the system needs to remain a multilateral system, but that some of the rules that exist today on the book are not adequate to deal with the reality of the Chinese system, and that China, if China really wants to preserve the system, China has to agree to sit at the table and to make some reforms. Now, what are those reforms essentially? First and foremost, it has to do with the role of state-owned enterprises. WTO rules do not cover the notion of state-owned enterprises. There is an article that deals with state trading enterprises that goes back to the origin of the GATT and to the fact that in the UK, in New Zealand, in Australia, in Canada, some of the original members, they were state-owned firms that were dealing with the trading of agricultural products, sort of state board companies for regulating the marketing of agricultural firms. But this was rather limited. And again, it was not, you know, those were economies that were liberal economies, that were market economies, where there was an exception someplace in the agricultural sector. It was not part of the system as such. It was rather the exception to the system. In the case of China, the state-owned firms are quite present in the working of the economy, and the WTO has been struggling with that when it has come to the dispute settlement system, to the appellate body. The system has struggled as to whether or not those state-owned firms can be considered as public undertakings, in which case it would fall under the rules of the subsidy and countervailing measure agreement. And that the rules in themselves would need to be clarified in order to have a clear decision on the part of the WTO that indeed the operation of those state-owned firms constitute, in a sense, subsidies, and that those subsidies are illegal. And just to make one point, one has to remember that China, which has been involved in a number of disputes on the receiving side as well, the European Union, the United States have attacked China on a number of issues. All of those cases that the European Union and the United States have put forward at the WTO against China have been won against China, and China in all the in the instances has abided by the rulings, has changed its functioning in order to be in conformity with WTO rules or WTO rulings. So China has not, in a sense, put itself in contravention to the rules. China has said, we abide by the rules, but in this domain, the rules are unclear. There are no rules, or the rules are not clear.
André, just to jump in here, and sorry for interrupting you already before the end of the 10 minutes, but just to focus a bit more and understanding a bit more what really is the issue with the SOEs. So you gave me some explanation and gave our listeners some explanation on what is the issue in a legal sense. When it comes to the various rules in the WTO, but what economically is the issue of SOEs? I mean, SOEs are state subsidized or state owned companies, big state owned companies. They probably in China receive very significant preferential treatment in terms of access to credit, perhaps even access to their own market. But to what extent is that an issue for the global trading system? Can you sort of walk us through the main economic arguments why SOEs are an issue and can be considered an issue? And then we turn to, you know, what can be the solution in the WTO? But let's first understand a bit more the issue.
Yes. So the issue has two elements. It's about the behavior of the state-owned firms in foreign markets. And it's also about the behavior of state-owned enterprises in the Chinese market itself. Now, let's start with the issue of the behavior, in our markets. In the European market, in this case, there the matter is indeed a matter of subsidy. So WTO rules do cover the issue of subsidies. If there are subsidies, there are possibilities for the importing country, let's say here for Europe, to take what is called countervailing measures, measures that counter the subsidy, sort of anti-subsidy measures. In the same manner that if you do dumping, you can take anti-dumping measures to protect your domestic firms from, let's say, this unfair behavior on the part of your competitor.
So in a sense, that's comparable to what the European Union is doing in its internal market with its state aid control, trying to prevent that companies that get subsidized by one country use those subsidies to conquer and enter into markets, market in the neighboring country at a too low price, basically pricing out companies out of the market.
Very much so. So it's the same logic, obviously taking into account that the WTO and the WTO secretariat and the way the WTO works is not quite comparable to the way the EU works. There's not a commission, which is an active body and that can take the kind of decision that the WTO secretariat takes. But in economic terms, this is exactly the same. In the European Union, we said that, you know, besides liberalizing market, we need also to ensure that there is not unfair behavior on the part of the states to promote their firms and to play within the single market on unfair unfair manner. The same notion is indeed present in the WTO, but just like in the EU, there are a number of conditions that attach to when one judges whether what the government does is considered to be a subsidy or not. You know, what is a state aid? And a state aid needs to have a number of conditions. Well, the same manner in the WTO to be considered a subsidy, well, the state must subsidize. And therefore, there is this notion whether the state-owned enterprises are considered or not as public undertakings, and therefore can be considered as receiving a subsidy from the state. And that needs to be clarified. All that would be required, in a sense, one doesn't need to change the WTO rules, one would need to have a clarification of the rules as to what falls under this notion of public undertakings. And if that were the case, that would clarify part of the matter here, and that would, I think that would solve part of the issues. But there is a second matter involved in China with the state-owned enterprise, is the behavior within China. And that refers partly to what you, Guntram, mentioned at the beginning, the forced technology transfer. Typically, when a foreign firm, a European firm, wants to operate in China, wants to invest in China, it needs to enter into a joint venture with a local firm, which can be either a private firm or a state-owned firms. Need not be a state-owned firms. In some cases, it is a state-owned. In some cases, it is not. When it is a state-owned, then indeed this forced technology transfer matter could be dealt with if the firm was viewed to be indeed a public undertaking, because then it would be the state that would be viewed as forcing this transfer of technology, and that would violate not WTO rules, but would violate some of the commitments that China has made that were China special rules that were incorporated in the protocol of accession. Because member states were aware, you know, the WTO member states were aware of the behavior of the Chinese state in with respect to technology and intellectual property. There were special rules for China.
In the protocol of accession.
In the protocol.
WTO,
that's right.
2001.
That's right. And the protocol of accession, if you want, contains rules that go beyond the rules of the WTO that applies to all of the countries. They were the special rules saying China is different, and therefore we are requiring China to take certain commitments, certain undertakings to respect. And again, there, those rules exist. One can bring disputes against China based on that, but again, one needs to have clarification about the nature of those firms, whether those firms are really public undertakings, that is, under the responsibility of the state or not. There would still remain the issue, which is quite common, that when European firms enter into joint ventures with Chinese firms, some of those Chinese firms quite often are private firms. So even if one had solved the state-owned issue, and one would therefore be able to tackle the question of forced technology transfer by those state-owned firms, there can also be forced technology transfer that is being implemented by firms that are private. Because private firms in China may be, although private, and all, you know, no ownership of the state, doesn't mean that the state has no moral suasion, either via the Communist Party or other means. And so that would still be an issue that needs to be solved. And one would therefore also need to have rules that are broader than simply the state-owned firms to deal with the issue of forced technology transfer, which is a very, very common complaint on the part of European firms that operate, that have investment in China, the fact that they are obliged to transfer part of their technology in order to be able to sign a deal with the Chinese firm.
So this sounds like, frankly speaking, a huge challenge, given the size of China, given the importance of SOEs in China, and given the reports that one reads, for example, by the Euro Chamber of Commerce, that is extremely critical on the issue of market access, on the issue of forced technology transfer. Similar complaints are, of course, also made by U.S. Industry associations. And, of course, also the recent paper by the German Industry Association, BDI, is extremely critical on those issues and wants things to change. So what is your proposal to solve this issue at the WTO? And perhaps you can sort of walk us through the mechanics of your proposal. And afterwards, we can perhaps discuss more broadly, how do we make sure that we actually get that kind of reform at the WTO?
So a proposal, in a sense, is both very ambitious and very modest. What is very ambitious is what you just said. China is a very important actor. And China is presumably reluctant to abandon not its system, but its behavior. So we are not after change of the system. We are not saying that China needs to have a regime change in order to continue to be a WTO member. I think that would not make any sense.
It wouldn't happen anyway.
It would not happen. That's right. So what we are after is a change of behavior. Of behavior that is would be, if one were to change some of the WTO rules or understanding, would then not be compatible with those new rules. So what is ambitious is, would China be willing to sign up to the reform of the WTO, or to some reforms of the WTO that would make its current behavior, which it has obviously chosen to do, would China be willing to constrain itself? In a sense, what China says that, look, we entered into the WTO and we accepted the Protocol of Accession, which was negotiated over many years, which is regarded in China as being already a very demanding protocol because of the fact that it contains a number of commitments on the part of China that go far beyond what is being required for other members. So China feels, we already paid that price. When we entered, okay, we agreed certain things we could not do. We agreed that we were different, and therefore we agreed to constrain ourselves in order to be compatible. And now you're coming back to us 20 years later and says, you want more. And so there is reluctance on the part of China to do that. And the question is, you know, how can one convince China to reform some of the WTO rules, part of them specific to some of the issues that are really in the nature of the Chinese system, the state-owned enterprise and the forced technology transfer. But presumably, one would need to have a reform which is broader reform, because there are other problems with the WTO. Just take one example, digital trade. When the WTO agreement was negotiated in the 1990s, well, there was no digital trade, or basically no digital trade. And there are discussions in the context of the WTO to bring new rules, because the world has changed, technology has changed. So there are a number of issues besides those that are related to China that need to be discussed. And, you know, people are talking of a WTO 2.0. But in this WTO 2.0, there are clearly some elements that would try to deal with some of the China matters. So I think one needs to work on the assumption, which has been expressed on a number of cases by the Chinese leadership, that they are indeed committed to a multilateral system. And to an understanding that this multilateral system to which they've belonged since 2001 has served them very well. China has transformed itself immensely over the years since 2001. Remember, you know, when China entered the WTO in 2001, it had a GDP per capita like Sudan. Mm-hmm. Today, its GDP per capita is a bit higher than Brazil's. So it has made huge inroads in improving the quality of life of its citizen and also in terms of its technological ability. And certainly the access to global markets and also the fact that it has been importing from its partners, all of this has participated to its success. So the question is, does China value sufficiently the system, the multilateral system, in order to agree to enter into reform? And the same obviously must be true for the United States and for the European Union, and presumably also for a number of other actors. So that has to be an assumption. If we are in a different world, where if we are in a world where all of those matters are to be simply fought over between the United States and China. And we hear, you know, the negotiations that are ongoing between China and the United States that cover very much the very same issue. That is a different matter. But this is something that, for instance, we in the European Union should not be welcoming. Because if China makes a deal with the US, because it will not be part of the WTO rules, we are not going to get the benefit of this, nor other members of the WTO. So China might say, yes, I'm giving to the US under pressure. I'm giving something, and that something would solve the problem, the political problem for Mr. Trump, would maybe even solve the political the problem for Mr. Xi, but this problem will be coming back, and we are after something that will solve the systemic issue that is being posed by China. And I think that's what one needs to work on, even though it's putting the bar much higher. So I realize that it's very ambitious.
But if I may, I mean, the issue of WTO reform is not a new issue, and the WTO arguably hasn't been able to make much progress on many, many dimensions, be it the negotiating arm, but now even the dispute settlement arm is under considerable threat. And arguably, the WTO, and I think that's what you also argue in vis-a-vis China, in the current system is not sufficiently able to change behavior that is actually economically problematic from a European or a US perspective. Now, you very much rejected the approach of President Trump, which is an approach of bilateral confrontation. But do you also reject the approach of the US, the European Union, and Japan to work together and confront China on a number of issues such as the intellectual property right issue? I mean, don't we need to sort of become confrontational? And we, that's the question, who is the we? But don't we need alliances that pose credible threats? And isn't it even helpful that Donald Trump is mounting a credible threat so as to enforce change and ensure a greater willingness of all parties to actually come back to the negotiating table and actually achieve a WTO reform, because we haven't achieved much?
So I think you're posing the problem extremely, extremely well. So I would say ultimately the question is, what is the goal? So is it a question of tactics? Is it a question of strategy? Is the goal to go back to the Geneva table? So you can say one is putting pressure, and you know, countries do that all the time. They try to nudge their partner towards their preferred strategy, and assuming that the preferred strategy is indeed to reform the WTO, and that, you know, each of the big actors may be reluctant to sit at the table for some of their own red lines, because everybody has their red lines. The Chinese have their red lines. We have red lines. Everybody has red lines. But, you know, you can sort of say, okay, I'm trying to push you there. You push me here. But then the goal is to prepare for the negotiation that we all agree should take place ultimately in Geneva. And, you know, you weaken a bit the red line, but then we go and discuss, and this is a multilateral deal. If this is what Mr. Trump is doing, then I think, yes, one would say it would have been helpful. You know, he would have a bit shaken the system, but he would have shaken the system not to destroy the system. He would have shaken the system in order to have the lines and the red lines move sufficiently to have grounds to go back among the main actors. And the main actors certainly need to involve the EU, China, and the United States, plus presumably a number of other important players, Brazil, India, at some stage probably Russia as well. So those main actors, they would need to agree on some reform. So if that's the purpose, I would have said yes, it's successful, and including indeed the negotiation that the EU, Japan, and the United States are having, those trilateral discussion. What I note is that there is uncertainty. I think there's very much the view of the European Union that we are participating in this trilateral discussion with the US and Japan in order to put some pressure in China, but to put pressure to go back to the table in Geneva. Whether this is indeed what the US is trying to do, there is uncertainty, because there is uncertainty about what Mr. Trump is after in many, many fronts, including in this one. So I don't think that the European Union, for right or wrong, in my view, for right, the European Union is not willing to go as far as to agree with the US and with Japan on a text that we would put on the table and tell China, this is take it or leave it. If you are not implementing this, those reforms, then we are taking aggressive measures against you, the kind of things that the United States has been doing. The European Union, at this stage at least, is not willing to go down this route. It's willing to put pressure. It's willing to sit with the US and Japan and to show to China that we do share the complaint of President Trump about China, but at the same time, we do not share, we the European Union, we do not share Trump's perceived, what we perceive, willingness to go to a confrontation that could destroy the system itself. Because that confrontation between China and the US could be a confrontation that of which something good comes or something terrible, which is the destruction of the system. And I note that in the recent summit between President Xi from China and President Macron, Chancellor Merkel, and President Juncker, that took place this week in Paris, there they talked about, let's say, a fair multilateral system. So both of them, both the Chinese side and the European side, committed themselves to work in a multilateral setting. But we, the European Union, we want this multilateral setting to be adapted to some of the issues that are not covered. So this is our view, and I think that's where we are willing to sit with the US to put the pressure, but not to go to the to the really aggressive unilateral action.
Well, for sure, what was very visible in the Paris summit that you mentioned is that the term that the European Union and the Europeans use vis-a-vis China is strategic competition, while the United States is using, of course, the term strategic rivalry. And I think that says a lot, because for the European Union, ultimately, it is in our long-term interest, it seems to me, to have a very close trading relationship with both the United States and China. China's market is going to increase, going to become even more important than it is currently for our firms. So the growth potential, even though Chinese growth is arguably going to be lower, is certainly on the Chinese side and not on the US side. So clearly we do want to find a solution. And I probably agree with you that we are not ready to go in as confrontational as the United States, and rightly so, because the US behavior, the way the US currently attacks the global trading system, is not just that they attack China, they also attack the global trading system through their actions vis-a-vis the European Union and others. So clearly the credibility of the US position vis-a-vis the EU, vis-a-vis the WTO, is, in my view at least, already eroding. I think we have had a very interesting and extensive conversation. Thank you for joining this podcast on WTO reform. Today we were featuring André Sapir, Professor of Economics here in Brussels and Senior Fellow at Bruegel.